into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No, I'm...
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
Yeah, you're welcome along to the football show. Full time, if you missed it earlier on today, Manchester City 1-0 winners against Brighton. They are now 4 points off Manchester United at the top of the table with a game in hand. They are coming up on the outside rails. And Spurs, half time against Fulham, 1-0 up, Harry Kane with the goal just before half-time. That is where we are in the Premier League this evening. Later on, we'll be joined by Damien Delaney, but very happy to say, in the meantime, we are joined by David Snaid, journalist and increasingly, I would presume, David, smug Manchester United fan. How are you doing?
Evening, Joe. What's the story?
I'm surprised you don't have an Ollie at the Wheel jersey on of some kind.
Oh, no, I was actually half tempted to go to a room and have like just a catalogue of pictures behind me, but I thought it'd be slightly professional, you know?
2012, the last time United were top of the table this deep into a season. For a man of your youth, that's a long time. It's a decade. That's a proportion of your lifetime suddenly.
No, I was living in Manchester for a couple of years before that, and then was actually managed to move home for a job, and was actually living back in Ireland at that point. I remember celebrating that league title, Alex Ferguson's last. Was in there, strutting down O'Connell Street, one of the nights from Manchester, couldn't get a ticket for the game, drinking a cheap bottle of champagne, and it was good times.
I would love to have seen the strut. It's a pity.
Just picture Bart Simpson. Remember that? I was on a business in The Simpsons, Bart Simpson in his jocks, but yeah, obviously he was fully dressed, of course.
I made the mistake last night of leaving the studio. I left the studio and I talked to Daniel McDonald at length about the FAI Damien Duff situation Monday, and invariably it had come up with David Myler on the football show yesterday. And then Daryl Horgan was a late booked guest, so obviously I had to bring it up with Daryl Horgan. So I walked out of the studio last night and said, I'm done now with FAI and Videogate. Like, I'm sick of this story. I was sick of this story a month ago. I'm really done. And then, lo and behold, I made the mistake of, you know, unless it's gone at least 1 a.m, you can never be safe that an FAI press release won't land. So here we are, Alan Kelly. He is asthmatic. He is in his 50s. And obviously, this virus is getting more serious by the hour at the moment. Mm. With COVID-19 still viciously circulating in our communities, said Alan Kelly in a statement, it's with a heavy heart that I've decided this is the right time to step down from my role. Now, if this was happening in isolation, away from Duff and away from Kelly's role post Videogate, you would absolutely look at that and say, well, that's fair enough. That's obviously the reason. But now, at the moment, it's hard to suspend thoughts that it's in some way connected with what's been going on. So talk to us. You start where you want to start, because you've been doing a lot of the legwork on this over the last few days, I know.
Yeah, well, first of all, if you were getting into a conversation with Dan, I imagine that would have went late into the night, because he's got a newborn too, so he's not getting much sleep. I was just talking about this earlier. Like, obviously, the story about Damien Duff broke on Friday and broke late in the evening. And I know it sounds really, I don't mean to be flipping about this, but one of the benefits of it happening in the middle of a lockdown was you kind of felt a bit more justifiable to ring or text people that late on a Friday night, because people are in lockdown and you probably have a better chance of getting them. You kind of feel, well, push me luck and go for it. And so anyway, only thing I had to do, unfortunately, missed the print deadline for the Irish Examiner, but managed to get a story up and was trying to get as much of a detail as possible, ringing around as many people as possible for the Saturday. And yeah, like, it's already being framed almost as if there's different camps or it's one or the other. And to be honest, I don't really see it that way more. So I just see it a case of you ring around and you try and get a sense of what's happening and the reasons for certain things happening. And that's what you report. Like, I straight away was getting in touch with people in the FAI, was getting in touch in people in the Duff side of things and the Stephen Kenny side of things, trying to get in touch with staff, players. And there was general disappointment that, well, more than disappointment, that Damien Duff had left. Like, people were really happy with the work he was doing. The word it was used was that he was adored for some of the work that he did on the training pitch and the manner in which he dealt with players and on the training pitch, but also outside it. And this is another thing that, even just from speaking to the players as well and to the staff, is that you kind of got a sense that what Stephen Kenny was trying to introduce, obviously, with Damien Duff and obviously with Keith Andrews in there too. And you're trying to find out, well, what's the reason for this? Like, was there a row? Was there a fall? And now, is there personal reasons going on? And it became apparent very quickly that this was it was personal in the sense of Damien Duff not wanting to be a part of the FAO anymore. And at first you're kind of thinking, well, why? Surely he knew what he was getting into. Some reasons were explained, and then it became clear that it was because of what happened over the video, over the speech, and how it was an investigation was carried out. And I don't think it was even so more so that there was an investigation, so to speak, or that the FAO looked into it, because I think by all intents and purposes, if something's brought to your attention that you're told something might not be right, I think it's only right and due diligence that you have to look into it. I think it was the manner of how the FAO went about it, and which Roy Parrott has admitted to kind of fanned the flames really and poured a bit of lighter fuel on the fire by saying that they were having an investigation as a matter of urgency, when like there could be times where you could get in touch with the FAO and ask them what FAO stands for, and you might be waiting for a while for them to tell you. So yeah. Like that became clear very, very quickly on both sides, that there was no falling out, and this was something that had been stirring from November, and then subsequently, even from speaking to people in the FAO, yeah, they were kind of saying, well, they didn't even feel that maybe Damien Duff wanted to work for them in the first place, and that Stephen Kenny had to convince them to even get on board. Which, when you read and listen to some of the stuff that's been said subsequently, which makes sense. So you hear Damien Duff coming out talking about how it was Stephen Kenny's vision that kind of wowed him. That's who he was doing it for. I don't think you can gloss over the fact that it's a big blow losing someone of his stature as a player, but also increasing influence as a coach. You can't dress it up and say it's not a blow. It is. And then obviously on top of that, you have the situation with Alan Kelly. He comes out and he leaves, and it happens so soon after. But everyone knows this has been bubbling. He's given his reasons in a statement. You take that on face value and you accept it. But then you also know, just from speaking again to people around the place, that it's clear that things weren't as great for him under Stephen Kenny as they might have been with Mick McCarthy, in the sense of maybe his influence around the place and just what was happening there, and obviously the whole video gate as well. So, and the speech that was made in the dressing room at Wembley. So again, I don't think Irish football seems to be littered where you're on one side or the other, but so far you're just on the side where you're trying to follow as much of the facts. That's what you try and do, and you can't argue with what's happened. It's been far from ideal. You look at what's happened, the results not great. You add in this upheaval, and it is a headache for Stephen Kenny. But to be framing it already in a sense of it's him losing the control of things or something like that, I think that's premature.
Two points on Kelly then. First one, when you say things may be slightly better for him under Mick than under Stephen Kenny, am I to interpret that to a degree as, well, we've got Keith Andrews, we've got Damien Duff, Stephen Kenny's very hands-on, maybe, you know, back in your goalkeeping lane a touch, thanks, Alan?
Yeah, possibly. Like, I know I saw Dan obviously reporting that, touching on that a little bit. Possibly, like, obviously he would have known Mick as well. Like, he never would have worked with Stephen Kenny before. Like, the people who I have spoken to would have said that Alan Kelly didn't want that video played. Obviously, Damien Duff had a hand in that video. Stephen Kenny had a major hand, obviously, of course, in that video. Maybe there's a touch, maybe perhaps, of he wasn't listened to, but that his advice wasn't taken on board. Listen, I can't speak to 100% what Alan Kelly's feelings were on the matter, other than, of course, that maybe he wasn't happy with it. But again, it's just from over the last few days, and I think you said it there, but kind of sick of it about kind of. Because it does just seem to be stuff talked about off the pitch. And you can't at the moment because there's no games for another couple of months, and then you have such, you do have the last few days that you've had, you can't not discuss it, but then you kind of speak to the players and you're speaking to around the place, and there's kind of like a sense that, like, players talking about how they can see the dynamic trying to be changed. You can see the environment around the place trying to be changed. Like, COVID has, obviously, in terms of the interaction and all the rest of it around the hotels and the team basically changed things dramatically. But, like, from what they're saying, they can see an environment trying to be created in terms of, like, even less downtime, where they're trying to have even more one-on-one meetings, which Damien Duff would have been a big part of. They're trying to have more even meetings as a collective, as a group, but also in that one-on-one setting. Like, there's, like, I don't want to say that compared to previous managers, because previous managers have had success. Previous managers are so experienced in the game and should be respected for what they've done. But, like, players talking about how they're enjoying meeting up with Ireland and what they're trying to do on a daily basis, even if they can't get the amount of training time on the pitch, that they're actually enjoying the work that's being done, because it's kind of just like a sense that, even like, I know this could probably be boring people, and not even so much boring people, and I don't mean to be patronizing, but like, people could be listening and saying, well, yeah, you can be talking about the fact that they're having more analysis meetings, they're having more one-on-ones, that recovery sessions are maybe timed a bit different, just treatment times, there's like individual kind of independent recovery and the training and preparation. And people are saying, yeah, but haven't won a match. And that's 100% understandable. Mm-hmm. But like, we're at a point where people were calling for something different. People were calling for a change, and we're calling for a kind of cultural review, in a sense, in terms of trying to change what's happening with Irish football. Got a manager coming in who's trying to do that. He's obviously he'd not had a good start. No one's arguing with that. He's now lost the tour in command, one of his very promising coaches, because he no longer wanted to work with the association. And then obviously there's the goalkeeping coach has left too. Come March time, that's the only thing that's gonna smooth things over. If from March time results and performances pick up, and you begin to see a bit of bear fruit of some of the work that is being done. And that's only from listening to people. And like, I think I said this before, like, if you almost feel as if I'm coming on being like a PR person for like the FAI, but the only reason being is because you're talking to people and you're hearing good things about what's happening behind the scenes. You're hearing positivity. You're not hearing major negativity from the sense of, this is a manager who hasn't got a clue what he's doing, this is a staff who haven't got a clue what they're doing. That's not what genuinely isn't what's being told to me. But and that's not just from one source or two, it's from different people. So you have to go with that.
On Kelly then, the second point I was going to put to you. So going back to Videogate for hopefully the last time ever, the reporting was that he had potentially been the source of the complaint over the video. Stephen Kenny shot that down and said that was not the case, that Kelly had not complained about the video. And the second point on Kelly with the video, he was furious that he was being painted potentially as the source of the leak, like absolutely furious, and came out to that effect. But you're saying at the same time, he didn't think much of the video, didn't think it was a good idea, didn't like the content, is it?
Yeah, well, that was just that apparently he'd gone to Stephen and said that maybe it wasn't a good idea, and that it wasn't something that he should have done.
Do we know why he didn't think it was a good idea?
I don't know. Like, that's the truth. Like, I think Damien Duff made the point saying, well, all it was referencing historical facts that are part of Irish history, you know? Now, in terms of his level of anger, it was very telling that he came out to make sure that he made sure that he got his point across by saying that he wasn't the leak by himself. He didn't go through the FAI, didn't do it through the FAI, which kind of I found curious enough. I wasn't sure what the reason for that was. Was that just maybe a case of him being able to just go straight on and do it himself? Again, that maybe it would be something that I'm sure people who are closer to him would be able to find out.
My impression was he was just so angry he wasn't going down the PR route. He wanted to speak plainly and just put this thing to bed. Emmett Malone in the Irish Times today, by the way, said that the general sense seems to be that the leak to the media was through a connection to a player who had never intended for the content of the video or Kenny's speech to become public at all. Now, who knows how these things get out?
But I think we chatted about this, I think, when around the time when this blew up. And like, this is the thing, like, there's so many players in and around, and it wasn't just players in there, it was like 20 odd people in and around the room who would have been there for it, you know. And like, if there's agents involved, people talk, people can get back to journalists. I don't think that it's necessarily a case of, oh, there was a leak who went giving the story to the Mail. It could have just been something that was relayed. I think the issue that has fueled really was the FAI's response to it, how straight away they came out saying that they're aware of it and were dealing with it as a matter of urgency, when it could have very easily have been sorted out in terms of getting to the bottom of it, because very quickly it became clear, like Gary Owens and his meetings, one-on-one meetings with, say, Damien Duff at Abbottstown, for example, I kind of had alluded to it previously, which I bought kind of basically, I said it this in copying exam, like Duff tore shreds through Gary Owens and basically said what an absolute disgrace it was that this was happening, how it was being dealt with. Mm. And was going in there basically saying that after being made to apologise, he was willing to resign. He would have resigned there and then. That's what I'm saying. This has been bubbling for a while. And obviously then it's just a feeling that Duff hadn't been able to shake. Like, I think there's even an acceptance that even from around the squad, that maybe it wasn't so much a leak that was went straight to the paper or over there, yeah, or from in the dressing room. As you say, like, there's so many people in and around footballers that it's stuff like this can get out, and then like maybe the nature of it just adds to it, just adds to the conspiracy. And then now obviously with Damien Duff leaving, people are gonna speculate, and I suppose it will only be even though I would stand over what I've already written, just in terms of getting it from the various sources, that is the reason why, until he actually comes out, you hear it from the horse's mouth, sure, well then people are going to just keep on going to be speculating and stuff, you know.
Either way, it's all a bit messy, and it's a pity, and geez, it's a costly fallout from a video in a friendly game against England, isn't it? I mean, if you're anti-Kenny out there listening to all this, you might well say, well, shouldn't Alan Kelly come into you about this video? And you know, this is Alan Kelly, who's been on Irish team buses for decades, who's sat through rebel songs and seemed to have no issue. Shouldn't it have given pause for thought, maybe, that he thought there was a problem with it? Others will say, look, you're the manager, you can't keep everybody happy, you have to do the job the way you see fit. And that's going to be open to interpretation. And so it's a big pity to lose Kelly. And then on the Duff front, I mean, still my overwhelming sense is like, fair enough, he's peeved at the FAI. Could this thing still not have been turned around? Could, you know, the right things not have been said to Duff? Like, was he still that furious however many months later that he felt, I have to get out of here, you know? Could more have been done to keep him?
In terms of more, obviously Stephen Kenny tried to convince him. Like, Duff went to him just around Christmas time and told him that this is still not a waiter, really, and this is what he was thinking. Was tried his best, gave him a bit of time to try and think about it, try to talk him around, and he's obviously a very headstrong person, I suppose. Yeah. Like, you have to respect it, and I think grudgingly he kind of did. And like, this is the thing, like, as well, like with Damien Duff, like he's out to, like, sing to his own tune, really, you know what I mean? He's not beholden to anyone. He's like it wasn't, if you look at it, like, I don't mean this in a way, but like, he's one of those players who's come through an area whereby he's financially set. He's not scrounging around for a job. If something doesn't feel right for him, even if maybe some of the people around him still do, if it doesn't sit well with him, he's kind of able to make the decision to leave. And that's what he's done. And as I said, like, there's people saying even the fact that Kenny was able to get him in the first place to be part of the FAI was almost like a little victory. And now you have obviously this happening, where it just, again, there's no getting away from it. And it's only because you have to look at it through the results as well, because that's what people look at it too. You can't ignore that. And when this happens, it's very, very far from ideal. But then luckily you've got March time where you have to try and begin to get on the right road again.
Yeah. You know, it's definitely a blow, especially Duff. I mean, the goalkeeping coach thing, I don't know how big a deal that is, frankly, but I guess it's just still not good, hot on the heels of Duff. Any word on replacements?
We've seen a couple of names. I don't think there's going to be a mad rush in it just for making calls and stuff. I think it's going to be something maybe over the next couple of weeks we'll will be sorted out. Obviously, like Lee Carsley is very prominent in that on that list. Obviously, serious caliber as a coach. We're seeing like England's under youth system now at the moment. There's like the 18s and 20s, manager of the 20s. When he worked at Man City, he's got serious pedigree, obviously, in international as well. See, John O'Shea is being mentioned. Mark Kennedy is a bit of an outsider. That was another name mentioned. And then just to make the point on the Alan Kelly thing, and this is just another, like, there's a suggestion that everything that was said in the speech was relating to, say, it was the Irish stuff and all the rest of it. But also said that maybe it could have been stuff said about like players and clubs that were in, mentioned that maybe he didn't really like either, you know, and
about them, like, not respecting Irish players kind of thing.
Yeah, and clubs are mentioned who maybe Alan Kelly would have an affinity to, you know, right. And yet there's players in that dressing room who are playing for those clubs, and then speak to them and they had absolutely zero problem with it. So you have to wonder, is it just a case of maybe someone realizing that maybe they're not going to have as much pull as maybe they might have had under previous managers, and find that hard to take as well. So I think you have to, everyone is going to spin an agenda their own way, I suppose, yeah. Really, and you have to just try and speak to as many people to get as rounded a picture of things as possible, and sometimes it can be difficult, you end up going around in circles, you know.
Okay, very last point, and can you keep this even to a minute if you can, because sorry, I've gone slightly over.
This is on Man United, is it?
No, it's not. Part of this whole story feels like there's forces working against the team or not having the best interest of the team. You know, Stephen Kenny alluded to that. Based on talking to people, did you get the sense from the people you're speaking to that that issue has been put to bed, or does that continue into 2021?
I would say I don't think it has been put to bed.
Okay.
I think what will happen is it could be very quickly some of the safe forces, but some of the stuff that if March goes well, you'll kind of maybe see things going down a little bit. But no, I don't think that's quite put to bed yet.
Great. David Snaith, brilliant stuff. Thanks so much for all that. Appreciate it.
No, but evening, John.
Cheers. Latest from Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, still 1-0 Spurs against Fulham, 54 minutes on the clock. Damien Delaney is with us next.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
Now, you're very welcome back. If you're just tuning in, Spurs are 1-0 up against Fulham. 54 minutes on the clock. Harry Kane with the goal. And Man City have beaten Brighton already this evening. Phil Foden cutting in off the now Phil Foden left-hand side and scoring with his right foot. So City, come Sunday evening, there is every chance Man City will be top of the table. They are coming up on the outside rails. Damien Delaney, good evening.
Joe, how are you?
I'm very well, my man. So listen, it's time for you to pull your neck in and give Ole Gunnar Solskjaer a bit of credit here.
You're opening with this, Joe. Yeah. I believe that my point still stands. I think I've been very consistent in what I said, and I don't believe that he is the man to get Manchester United back to the standard or where the bar is set for Manchester United. You know, since we last spoke, he had three stabs of getting out of the Champions League group and failed at all three. They were beaten in the cup semi-final off Manchester City. They are top of the league. He's done better than what I thought he would have done. I mean, when he was 15th in the league, I thought he was going to get sacked. He wouldn't see the end of the season. I think now he quite rightly will see the end of the season and get a chance to see it out. But ultimately, I mean, even the most optimistic about United fans doesn't truly believe they're actually going to win the league. And I just think that Man United fans being genuinely happy that the fact that they're just gone top in January just shows how starved they are of any glimmer of light. I think Manchester City, that juggernaut, just seems to be getting moving now, and I think it's going to be very hard to stop. I mean, when you look, they've got 36 points from 17 games. It's a reasonable haul. It's not a huge amount when you look at the standard over the last 3 or 4 years. But having said that, they are top, and that doesn't matter. They can only be where they are. And as I said, because they are top, he does get to see it out. But you got to talk about progress for Manchester United. What did they finish last year? Third, Joe. I think at best they're going to finish second this year. I mean, that would be a really, really good season for them. So he has to win an FA Cup. He has to win the Europa League or he has to win the Premier League because that would be progression. I still stand by it. I mean, that squad that was involved last night was 450 million quid. I mean, it's quite easy to mix up what I'm saying, that Manchester United are useless, they're never going to win a game. I mean, 450 million quid, of course they're going to win games. Yeah. But I don't see them winning trophies. You know, you can't even get past the semi-final. That's incredible. You know, at least Van Gaal won an FA Cup, Mourinho won a League Cup, a Europa League. I mean, is the football fantastic? You know, if you wanted to say, you know, he's playing better football than Van Gaal, fair enough. They're playing better football than Mourinho, possibly. But at the same point, they're not playing as good as Man City. They're not, I don't think, as good a side as Liverpool. You saw the other night in the League Cup semi-final. There's a clear gulf in the two teams.
Yeah. Look, I'm not necessarily sure Solskjaer's the right man either. But to throw a few points back at you. Let's park comparisons to Liverpool and Man City for a second, because they can only compare themselves to where they had been. You know?
Absolutely.
And I would say when Van Gaal won the FA Cup and promptly got sacked, don't forget, and even when Mourinho won the Europa League, there was never the sense of progress that there is currently, or the sense of jazz about the team, or sense of, you know, this is a team equipped to play decent football and beat most teams. They always felt very vulnerable under Van Gaal in particular, and under Mourinho, the whole thing was so toxic all the time anyway that, you know, there was just a nasty feeling about the place, and the football was so dire. So in comparison to those two with their cups, I wouldn't overestimate the cups, because a sense of progress is just as important. And so, totally take your point on the money that's been spent, for sure. Look, they should be about where they are. But some things which impress about Solskjaer, the way he kept his head when it looked like he was on the verge of getting sacked. Most managers have a meltdown interview somewhere in the midst of that. And to be fair to him, he really did keep his head. The other point which jumps out is his handling of the Pogba situation. Like, we're talking about Solskjaer. Is he a manager of authority? And, you know, he's not going to scream at players in a Glaswegian accent. And he's not Jurgen Klopp on the pitch showboating to everyone. And he's not Pep in his fancy clothes. He's just doing his old thing quietly. He's been himself. But there is a bit of an iron fist there. And it's evident in his handling of Pogba. Because Mino Raiola was causing havoc. And now Solskjaer has got to a point where Pogba does not know if he's starting against Liverpool. In fact, with McTominay and Fred, he's probably not starting against Liverpool. And that's just the way it is, Paul. And Solskjaer's picking the team he wants to pick, and he's beholden to nobody, including Pogba. Someone like a Jesse Lingard, like emblematic of kind of the mediocrity at United, has not started a Premier League game in a year. In a year, that's just been done. That's over. Van de Beek signed. People giving out, why isn't he playing? Well, he's not playing because Solskjaer doesn't want to play him, and he's not going to bow down to the pressure that comes with being a United manager. Lots of others would, and I think, you know, with his whole not wanting to park in Alex Ferguson's car spot initially, and that kind of hung around him, there was a sense he was weak in some way. I think you would have to say, in the last 6 months, in all those little ways I've illustrated, there is a backbone there that you have to recognise, no?
But possibly, but I think to take up on your initial point there, Joe, of there has been progress and there's a jazz about the team.
To a point.
I mean, like, is that because that they've got good PR now and that there seems to be, you know, quite good kind of...
I think, sorry to interrupt, it's Bruno. Like, Bruno Fernandes is... Yeah. And like, but look at that. Great managers have to make great signings. And mm-hmm. Bruno was a great signing. And you know what? When Cavani signed, I think a lot of United fans thought, oh my God, Cavani a little bit over the hill. What a brilliant, shrewd signing. So, like, you know, he's making better signings as well, you would have to say.
Sure, I'm not sure you say Cavani's a shrewd signing. I mean, they signed a Gallo too. I mean, Cavani's come in and done reasonably well. He's 33 and he was on a free transfer for months, you know, even from January before they signed him in October. Nobody touched him. He's a decent player. He's not going to give you 40, 50 games a season. He's not going to score you 20, 30 goals.
No, like, but hasn't he scored at those crucial big moments? He's delivered for them. He's done well.
He's done reasonably well, yeah, but I'm just saying the long-term future of Manchester United, where is it? But, I mean, look, I'll grant you he has done better and he seems to have found some sort of a rhythm. I still think tactically Manchester United are really, really poor. Right. I still believe that. I mean, Fernandinho in the Cup semi-final, basically that's what Manchester United are lacking because one Fernandinho did the job of two people in McTominay and Fred. You know, you'll get away with playing the Matic's last night against Aston Villa, but you won't get away with playing a single holding midfield player. They have to play two because the centre-backs aren't good enough. I've consistently made that point and blue in the face from saying it. So they need to go and find a good number six. But on top of that, then, I just don't think that they're, you know, they lose too many big games. I mean, and you can't argue that. They've lost semi-finals. They're clear golfing class to the blue side of Manchester. Liverpool seem to have found a rocky patch. I believe that Liverpool will get themselves going again and will get moving. And I believe the league will come down between those two. Now, he might surprise me. Manchester United might want to win the league, and that would be fair enough. As I said, I don't even believe the most optimistic of Manchester United fans would believe that. But I do agree with you to a point that he has done better. Fernandes and Rashford really are a huge part of that.
Yeah. And would you say Solskjaer, I mean, look, this is probably a redundant question. If ultimately you don't think he's the right person for the job, if that's your opinion, then there's just no point hanging around. But on some level, would you say, well, based on the signings of like the likes of Fernandes and the recent improvement in the team and even Cavani, you know, other teams could have taken him, they didn't. Solskjaer deserves the opportunity to try and find that six and to try and find those fullbacks and then to see what he can do.
I still believe he's lacking as a manager, even if he got two fullbacks. I mean, Wan-Bissaka's got one goal, one assist. Yeah. I think Luke Shaw's not even got a goal or an assist this season. So they're getting no, you're quite right in saying that. They have to play with two defensive midfield players, which means they're relying on four players every week to win them games. You know, Rashford, Fernandes, Cavani, and probably Martial. You know, if you could play with one number six, you could free up Van de Beek to play in there with Fernandes, and Manchester United might get a bit more joy. Tactically, I think Manchester United are a little bit short. I believe he makes too many poor decisions in big games and has cost Manchester United.
Could you give me one example of that? I'm not saying you're wrong, but I'm just
curious. In the Champions League, he did three stabs at getting out of it. I mean, ultimately, right, Manchester United start games. Even last night, take, for example, Burnley.
Yeah.
They're very, very, very submissive early on in games. They don't really, I mean, I'm watching Tottenham tonight, and as soon as the game kicked off, they took control of it. I watched Manchester City early. As soon as the game kicked off, they took control of it. No, they're not going to control the game for 90 minutes, but they set a tempo, they control it. I think Burnley were reasonably good in the first half, but Burnley got to implement their game plan in terms of, you know, clipping long balls forward, and Manchester United defended very, very well. But at no point, maybe in the second half a little bit, they kind of asserted some amount of control on the game. And I believe that when you play against top teams, if you can't gain some level of control early on in a game, you're going to get beat. And that's why they get beat off big teams. That's why they get beat off good teams. Mm. Even Besiktas here in the Champions League, even in Leipzig, and even at who's the last game? PSG as well, sorry, in the third chance they had to get out of the division.
Yeah.
And I just believe that in tight games, in big games, players want to have the confidence in a manager that, you know, they've been sent out there with a clear game plan, a clear way of winning, so that when things aren't going their way, they feel comfortable in falling back on something. I think a lot of footballers need to have that. And I don't believe that Manchester United do.
Okay. I'm starting to sway back to thinking he's doing a very, very acceptable job. And I think he does send them out with plans, actually. I think you can see them playing with very different plans in different games.
I absolutely don't. They're so off the cuff, it's unbelievable. They're one of the most off the cuff teams I've seen, you know. But why is he judged off a different standard of other Manchester United managers?
But he's the first manager to have him top of the table 17 games in since 2012. That's the true test of consistency, isn't it?
He's been there for 2.5 years, Joe. He's not even been in a final. I mean, you cannot.
But
like,
Mourinho, Van Gaal, Moyes, none of them got United to the top of the table 17 games in. So
January, Joe. That's what you're. I mean, that's what I talk about with Man United fans. They're so low right now.
They are so low. But you can only judge them by their own standards. So he's had to clean up a lot of that lowness, a lot of that crap. Joe, like, get rid of all these players.
Even in the recent past, they had three goals getting out of the Champions League and they failed every one of them, and they lost the other night to Manchester City. Even when they were desperate to make it to a final.
I know.
If he wins a trophy this year,
yeah,
then I'll start saying, then you and me can start having a conversation. I go, okay, fair enough.
So are you saying you think Van Gaal did a good job because he won the FA Cup? I mean, what the hell is that worth? It doesn't matter.
I never said Van Gaal did a good job. I just said he won a trophy.
Yeah, but boo-hoo. You know, he got sacked. No one cares about the FA Cup. It doesn't actually matter.
But you said, your opening statement was Manchester United have made progress. You know, let's park the cups for a second. Have they? I mean, you know, they're 36 points from 17 games. I mean, Jose Mourinho finished second, and he stated that it was his greatest achievement as a manager, getting that Manchester United to finish second.
Yeah.
Second in January, or would I mean, what's progress for Manchester United this year? I mean, what, you know, they finished third last year, yeah. So second and no trophy.
Final. It's hard to judge this year because it's hard to know what effect COVID has had on all the teams. Like Liverpool, clearly nowhere near where they were. So in that sense, it's an easier season for Manchester United. But then, if COVID has affected Liverpool, you have to be fair and say it's probably affected United as well. Absolutely. I think a sign of progress would be. Not if they win the league, because they're clearly not the best team in the league. If they can hang in and make some kind of a title race that everyone knows they're probably not going to win, but make some kind of a title race out of this up until mid to late April, you know, still be in it mathematically, still part of the conversation, then that represents some progress. Now,
are those standards acceptable for Manchester United, being in a title race in April?
I mean, not if you're David Moyes straight off the Alex Ferguson season, but if you're Ole Gunnar Solskjaer straight off the last 6-7 years, it's a bit more acceptable.
But he's had 2.5 years and he's spent an incredible amount of money and he's not been to a final. Mm. And Manchester United is the biggest club in the UK. They are an outfit that is built on winning. Winning is the only thing the club understands. He's had 2.5 years. He can't get past the semi-final. He spent 280 million quid. Yeah. That team last night was 450. They beat Burnley 1-0. They're top of the league in the middle of January. I think he needs to win a trophy this year and then finish second, and that's progress. But if he finished third last year and he finishes second at best this year, at best, and no trophy, no final, can you say that's progress?
Might depend on the nature of the second. I mean, it's still only January. I can't speed up time, so he can only do what he can do at the moment.
But how long is he going to be given then? 10 years?
Because
the pace
minimum.
He's moving at. That, like, you know, next year, if he finishes second and they take it to the last couple of games of the season and he makes an FA Cup final, you can argue that's progress as well, you know? Yeah. I just think that Manchester United need to be back to being what they are, which is winning leagues, challenging for leagues every year, latter stages of the Champions League every season, and pretty quick, you know, the longer they wait, the tougher it's going to be. And I just don't believe this guy has that. You say that he has got kind of an iron. What did you say?
Look, there's a certain steel there that you may not have suspected was there when he wouldn't park in Alex Ferguson's spot for the first couple of weeks.
But what when you say he handled Pogba, what did he? What when you say handled, what did he do? He just ignored it, really, with the Mino Raiola stuff. Everyone was
An example of that then. Mourinho, in that instance, all hell breaks loose. Like, Mourinho was falling out with Pogba anyway. Solskjaer came out strongly against Raiola, basically called him a disgrace or whatever, and had some curt enough words that his agent needs to realise it's a team game. Maintained very good relationship with Pogba, kept him on side. Pogba hasn't gone off and sulked. Pogba's now in and out of the team whenever Solskjaer wants to pick him, and Pogba seems to be going along with this. He may miss the game at Anfield. So I think that's a well-handled situation,
Jose Mourinho's a winner, serial winner, and he understands that the team comes first.
He's only third in the league.
I know, but over his course of his career, he's a serial winner, Mourinho, and he understands what it takes to win leagues. Yeah. He's won them everywhere he's been. And he understands that you can't have people like Pogba paddling their own canoe, doing what they want, because it creates unrest in the changing room. Yeah. Now, I'm pretty sure he tried to handle Pogba the correct way and speak to him and talk his agent down. But it gets to a point where if the player is having a negative effect on the team and they're not winning the league, he's quite right to say, this guy is undermining me. So he decided, I need to deal with his Pogba problem once and for all. And maybe he did get frustrated. And I believe that's the case.
But Solskjaer may well think, for all we know, privately, you might be chatting with Solskjaer privately and he might say, look, medium term, I want Pogba out. But it's good management to use what you have while you have it.
Absolutely.
So and he is using that's why I think the Pogba situation pretty well handled. I mean, look, I'm kind of playing devil's advocate with you a little bit, so I don't want to come too strongly as if I think Solskjaer is the answer. I'm not necessarily sure.
No, not at all. These are all valid. These are all valid questions, and I've got no problem asking them. I genuinely do. But I mean, I just don't see that he's got that steel, that real tenacity that when players lose semi-finals, that you when you lose games or big games or important games or any game really, you want to be sitting at home on Saturday night thinking to yourself, I don't even want to go in tomorrow because I'm getting both barrels. I just and you want to have that. I wouldn't say fear, but level of I don't want to let the manager down. I don't want to I can't do it. And I just don't believe Solskjaer does that. I mean, he's forever smiling, He's a nice, happy guy and he doesn't put any serious pressure on the players.
But then by the same token, we could have another conversation and we could say that the Martin O'Neill, Roy Keane, you know, scream at the players type of management is ancient history, and like it's past it, and you can't talk to players like that anymore, you know?
I never said, fair enough, but you still want to have a level of like, I'm going to get dropped or I'm going to not play for Manchester United if I don't perform in the big games. I mean, fair enough, maybe not the shouting one, but you still want to have a level of respect or fear that the manager is going to take drastic action if I don't perform in big games. But look, Joe, we can argue or talk about it.
I would never argue with you.
Absolutely. We can talk about the goals go on, but sure. Ultimately, he's not won anything. He's not been to a final, and I think that's not good enough for Manchester United.
No, that's fair.
And ultimately, that's my stance, and you know, he's done better than what I thought he did. I didn't think he would see the new year. I'd say when the last time you and me spoke. But like you said, maybe the league's a bit off this year, and the pack have kind of come back to the top two have come back to the pack, as opposed to anyone, as I said, it's at Manchester United's points, total of 36 points from 17 games. It's decent, yeah. It's not amazing by the standards that Liverpool and Man City have set over the last number of years, but you know, I think Liverpool will get themselves going eventually. They're in a bit of a lull at the minute. I think Manchester City are pretty much up and running, and it'd be hard to see them being stopped this year.
Well, look, I'll only invite you on for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer debates when United are top of the league or doing well, because that suits me. That's how this is going to work. Just FYI. Like, when they're in seventh in about a month, don't expect the phone call.
No problem.
Can I give you Man City's next few games, by the way?
Go on, then.
Crystal Palace at home, Sunday evening. This is after the game at Anfield. And if things go a certain way, they'll be beating Palace at home to go top of the table. So they've got Palace at home. Then their trickiest game is probably Villa. But it's Villa at home, so you'd back Man City. Then they have West Brom. Then they have Sheffield United. Then they have Burnley, who they always beat. And so suddenly, it's the 6th of February, and they play Liverpool. And they could well be... I mean, you could easily see them having maximum points from then, or from now until then. They're starting to look really good. One of the things we're hearing about City is they've tailored their training to come good around now. Is that, on your understanding of pre-seasons and being a Premier League footballer, is that a genuine possible thing you can do, that suddenly you get this burst of fitness at a certain point later in the season?
I made this point a couple of times. I was on a lot of Man City games in Europe, and they certainly seemed to be playing within themselves. You know, they were. I thought they looked very... I suppose I might have described them as lethargic or one pace, but they were very, very comfortable. And I did say that it wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility that Pep Guardiola is going to keep them in second gear and realizing that they can crank it up the back half of the season. It certainly seems that that's the way he's gone about it, and his experience of being in England, you know, the Premier League, the League Cup, the FA Cup, the Champions League, it was impossible to go foot to the floor in all four competitions, and he definitely seemed to have the reins on them the first half of the year, because the way they cranked it up now. The other point I have to make is Diaz, the centre-back coming in, has made a huge difference to them.
Yeah.
Not just the fact that he's a fantastic defender, but it's freed up Fernandinho to go and play in the middle of the park again. And he is a proper centre midfield player. I mean, they missed him for a year playing at centre-back because they missed him out of the middle of the park. And obviously, he's not a natural centre-back. And I think he struggled there a little bit at times. But having him back in the middle of the park alongside Rodri, who is the main passer and sets the tempo and gets it going. But Pep has understood that you need a dog in there to win the battle first and foremost. And maybe Rodri didn't have that in him because he is a neat and tidy footballer. But I think Fernandinho coming into that number six role and obviously Diaz and the resurgence of John Stones as well all seems to come together nicely. De Bruyne looked fantastic again today when I watched him. And they really do seem to be moving through the gears. And hopefully, you know, they can really kick into top gear, because they are a fantastic sight when they're in top gear.
Yeah, hold that thought. I want to ask you about Stones. And actually Foden out in the left as well has been interesting the last couple of weeks. But there has been a goal at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. 76 minutes on the clock here. They were 1-0 up. Here's Nigel Bidmead.
Tottenham 1, Fulham 1, the visitors equalising in the 74th minute, and it's another terrific header, this time from Ivan Cavallero, his second of the season. Ademola Lookman honours a substitute cross from the left, and Cavallero planted the header beyond Lloris. Tottenham 1, Fulham 1.
Yeah, there you are. There's Jose Mourinho, serial winner against 18 on the table.
Lee, can I just say that, just a quick point on Tottenham, Højbjerg in the middle of the park, I think, is a huge difference for Tottenham. You know, I mean, he really is a top class defensive midfield player. The goal came totally against the run of play. Tottenham have had a host of chances. I'm just watching it here. But just similar to Manchester United, you know, to have that proper number six in that midfield for Tottenham really has made a difference for them.
I've always been rooting for John Stones since we had a chat about him one evening, and you were saying you'd bumped into him and he was, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I got the impression someone, a touch of a worrier, conscientious type, was, you know, could get in on himself a little bit, was the way I interpreted it. So he's played the last seven games alongside Diaz, forming a partnership, playing well, starting to grow into it again. I mean, this is great. I think it would have been such a pity if he'd been lost to, a really good club, because he's such a talented, enjoyable player to watch.
Yeah, super, super, super player. Technically fantastic, quick, everything really. Just moments or lapses. Oh my God, Tottenham are in again. Or Fulham nearly scored again. God. Sorry. really, really, really top player. I mean, really good. And I'd say this year was pretty much last chance saloon for him. He kind of was out of the picture for a long period and kind of got in just by default, really. But he's taken his chance and he really looks to have matured. Having Diaz alongside him and Fernandinho in front of him has really helped him too. But he's been brilliant. I'm delighted for him because he is such a good player.
How are you watching this game? What channel is it on?
Premier.
Ah, right.
Ruben Loftus-Cheek just nearly went through one-on-one there, and Lloris made an unbelievable save. But Tottenham have been pretty good tonight. They've had a host of chances. I mean, Jose will be raging that they didn't take at least one more of them. But it's 1-1 with 12 minutes left.
Look, they're third in the table. He's doing really well. So, before I let you go, actually, I'm going to skip Foden to ask you this instead. So I put this to David Myler last night and he had an interesting answer. Micah Richards was on the BBC website the other day, and the headline was one of the most inspirational people I've ever met by Micah Richards. And I thought, wow, interesting. And it was James Milner, you know, and he was talking about Milner, the teammate, approachable, reliable. You could phone him at midnight, he'd answer the phone. Yeah. Just so important around a dressing room in all the ways you probably can't measure with statistics and, you know, these more tangible ways of measuring what a player brings to a team. So I asked David Myler, I'll ask you now, I'm putting you on the spot, I know. Is there a player that you played with that you would put into the category of inspirational in the way Milner was?
What, that you could talk to him and stuff?
Just that you would have looked at him and just thought, he's the way he conducts himself as a professional is, you know, borderline inspirational. I couldn't admire that person, you know, on off the field more.
Yeah, there was when I was young enough at Hull City, we signed Nick Barmby. At the later stages of his career, we were in League One at the time, and he was very, very similar. Such a good fella, right? Really, really nice guy. He was a local lad from Hull. He was coming home to his hometown club.
Yeah.
And I think he was 34, 35 at the time. But again, just to watch him in training, his work ethic, you know, coming in as a young guy and as a young professional, kind of finding your way in the game, just seeing him coming in and the way he conducted himself around the training ground, his desire to win, you know, the way he trained, the level that he trained at when he did train was something else. And he set a fantastic standard for us. And that's something that I always took with me in my career as well. It's an everyday thing. So he'd be the one I picked, to be honest with you.
Yeah, interesting. See, like a great career, Everton, Liverpool, Leeds, and would never have given Nick Barmby much of a thought in my life.
Yeah, really nice fella, like really, really, really good fella. I mean, for young pro, you know, Peter Taylor was the manager, signed him at the time, and we had a lot of young guys in our squad. There was, you know, a lot of guys, 21, 22, 23, and Nick came in and he was brilliant for all of us because we were all, as I said, finding our way, and he was almost like the father-like figure for the whole thing, and he's one guy that would always stick in my mind. That I learned a whole lot from just speaking to him on away trips, you know, long away trips in the buses, just talking and stuff. And he gave me great insight to what it was to be a professional footballer.
Okay, brilliant. I might try and nag Nick Barmby for an interview now. We're always looking for, like, who was not a nice guy. It's nice to do a section where we're like, who was a good guy? So, Nick
yeah,
Barmby, there you go.
Nick would be a great one, yeah.
Okay. So, listen, I don't know when I'll talk to you again. It won't be if Man United are faltering, but if they're doing really well, obviously,
on. No, you call me any you want, man. I'll happily. Like, I mean, if Man United do go on and win the league, though, I am throwing my phone in the river.
Oh, man. I mean, COVID or no COVID, you're coming into the studio for 3 hours. We've a lot to talk about. All right, I'll let you go. See you later.
Go on, thanks.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.